From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1929 on a train where a young Irish girl named Niamh was leaving New York City. Niamh lost her entire family in a fire that destroyed their tenement building. And now, as an orphan, she was bound for the Midwest with the hope of finding a new home. Niamh's story was told in a novel called Orphan Train by Christina Baker Klein. While Niamh is a fictional character, her experience represents that of about 200,000 children that were placed on so-called orphan trains between 1854 and 1929. During that period, there weren't any social welfare programs for kids in need, no foster care, no child labor laws. A Methodist minister named Charles Loring Brace decided that a way to help the children and help populate and work the land in the Midwest was to send orphaned children there. Children who were part of the orphan trains have described their experiences as lonely, isolating, challenging, having to adjust to new families, working in tough conditions, and starting a new life alone. That loneliness and uncertainty are also felt by hundreds of thousands of children today who have been orphaned, who are part of a foster care system, or have been separated from their families at the U.S.-Mexican border. Orphan trains are part of American history that many of us may not know much about. And we're going to learn a little bit more about that this hour, and you can participate in an immersive reenactment of an orphan train this coming weekend. It's part of a series of events presented by Children Awaiting Parents, all for National Adoption Month. We'll also talk about how to help children navigate the emotional impacts of entering or exiting the foster care system, whether it's at home, at school, or in the community. And you ought to know there are opportunities for families in this community. There's probably no one listening who doesn't know someone who's at least floated the idea, talked about adoption at some point, been interested. It's a great opportunity to learn a lot more this hour. Let's welcome our guests who are in studio. Lori McKnight is Executive Director of Children Awaiting Parents and the Donald J. Corbett Adoption Agency. Lori, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Also with us is Veronica Black, who is Adoption Program Supervisor for Children Awaiting Parents, also an adoptive parent herself. Veronica, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Alicia Dougherty is an adoptive parent. Alicia, welcome to you as well.
Thanks.
There's so much to kind of talk about in terms of the experience for adoptive parents. And I think Veronica and Alicia, we're going to learn about what you and your families have experienced and what that process has been like. I think there are questions that people who are considering adoption have. Sometimes it's a stereotype that's not based in reality. Sometimes there's a lot of realistic concerns. And there's questions about what the opportunities are for families. So we're going to hit all of that this hour. But I have to kind of start by saying, and I'll start with Lori, I'd never even heard of orphan trains. And I think I do a decent amount of reading. But there's a lot of things that we kind of go through the educational system not really knowing much about. And this event this weekend, I think, is so interesting. But I think most people probably have heard a little or not at all about this. What do you think?
I agree with you. I think it is a little known event and a little known concept.
Yeah, so I'm looking at the event this weekend. It's the Orphan Train Immersion Experience Saturday, 11 a.m. at the New York Museum of Transportation. That is out on East River Road in West Henrietta. It's actually a really cool place. If you've got young children who love trains, you've either been there or you should be there. It's really neat there. But in this case, the reenactment experience will allow attendees to receive a card describing the circumstances of a child who actually rode on the orphan train. And then it's just a 14-minute ride around the track as improvisers acting as chaperones will kind of work with the participants, and should be very, very interesting. Veronica, what do you think people get out of an event like that?
Well, I think they'll walk away with a better understanding of what the children have experienced. A lot of the trauma, the fears of, you know, being bounced around, the fear of the unknown, you know. So I think they'll walk away with a better understanding.
Well, and I think it's also important to kind of back up when you hear the term Children Awaiting Parents to understand what exactly the organization is, how long you've been there, and what the mission is. So I'll ask Lori and Veronica to do that. Lori, what's the brief definition for Children Awaiting Parents?
Basically, we are an agency that is matching families to children in hopes of finding children their forever homes and getting to an adoption.
And how long has it been around?
I think the CAP agency's been about 45 years.
A little over, yes.
Okay, and Veronica mentioned before the hour began, this is a time where there are opportunities for families in this community. So we've got plenty of time here, and I want to talk about what those opportunities are, how they relate to people listening right now. What is the current climate with adoption and the opportunities as you see them, Veronica?
Well, opportunities, there's tons of opportunities. We have, from my experience alone, speaking with families who have expressed interest in possibly adopting, they are afraid of the unknown. They have that fear. So what I like to do is explain to them that we are a little different from foster care agencies, mm-hmm. because that's not what we are. We don't do foster care. Our focus is permanency, finding forever families for children. And explaining to them that we focus on identifying what families can and cannot handle, helping them to identify their strengths and their weaknesses. And although foster care placed children based on the availability of a bed, you know, not specifically on the strengths and the needs of the children and the families. So, you know, getting that piece out there, letting people know that we're not going to just drop off a kid in your home whose needs are greater than what you can handle. So we have informational meetings, okay, that are set for the community, and it's open to the community. It's free. Those informational meetings are the second and last Tuesday of every month at 6 p.m. at our office. And we also have a training process that families would have to, they're required to go through in order to become an adoptive parent. I also want to take a couple steps back and share that our focus at Children Awaiting Parents has always been waiting children, older children, children with special needs, children who have waited the longest and are considered harder to place, children who may be part of a sibling group that wish to be placed together, kids who are school age, you know, it could be teenagers, minorities, kids with both emotional and physical disabilities. So families who are interested in adopting that healthy infant or international adoption, that's not an area that we specialize in. We do have families who call us, and we direct them to the right organizations. But I just want to make that a little clear for your listeners who may be considering adoption and considering us. So we do have that training that's available, and it is required that the families take the training class. And the training class, like I said a moment ago, is to help families identify their strengths and to educate them on the needs of the children. We focus on issues such as loss, attachment issues, stuff like that, and just to give them a better understanding and equip them with the skills needed to help those children overcome their needs.
Sure. And so a couple of questions before we kind of get into both Veronica and Alicia's experiences, which are I think really, I think, going to illustrate exactly some of the benefits and some of the great stories that can come from this. Do we know, if I missed it again, how many children in our area are waiting for forever homes? Do we know?
Well, Monroe County has over 400 children in the foster care system currently. And you know, New York State, I want to say we have what? Is
I think
it
about 18,000.
Yeah.
18 to 20.
Yeah. And within the United States, we have over 100,000 children who are waiting for, you know, adoptive families. So there's a large number of children.
Okay, so hundreds right here in Monroe County alone. And, of course, as our listeners across the Finger Lakes all the way down to Ithaca, mm-hmm. most of the way to Syracuse, stretching into Canada, but west of Buffalo, you know, it's a big, big wide range. So we're talking hundreds, well into the thousands of kids potentially waiting for what they would call forever homes. And when you talk about the training that's involved, mm-hmm. helping families understand what it would require, I don't mean this cavalierly. I'm genuinely curious if that, I don't want to phrase it the wrong way, it kind of reduces the amount of families that are ready. Do you have families who start that process and say, whoa, like, I don't know that we were ready for this, does it?
Yes, we do. Some of the families realize that this is a bit much, you know, and that it's not something that they can handle, you know, and that's okay.
You want them to realize that before they get there.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Any idea what percentage do most of the families who start the training, do they go through with the full process?
Well, a large percentage do. You know, we have a couple who have said, you know, we think that we want to do the infant adoptions, or we're going to try the international route. So, and it's understandable, and it's okay, because we need to know that ahead of time.
All right. If you want to get in touch, by the way, as we go throughout the hour, when you're hearing about the services and the work done by this particular organization, Children Awaiting Parents, what's the best way to get in touch, Veronica?
Well, we have our website, and that is www.childrenawaitingparents.org, or they can also call our office, which is 585-232-5110.
I want to turn to Alicia Dougherty, who I think your experience should really help us see the potential here. And it goes back to, why don't you kind of take me through your family story and how you ended up involved here?
Sure. About 9 years ago, my husband and I wanted to start a family. It didn't happen the biological way. And we looked at all the different routes there are to adoption, and the foster adoption route seemed like a good fit for us. There's 108,000 children in our country waiting for a family, and all we wanted was a child. So it was definitely a good fit for our family. We met Veronica Black, and she was actually our MAP trainer. MAP is the name of the classes that you have to take to adopt from foster care or to be a foster parent. So we took the 10-week classes.
What was that like? Do you remember what that was like?
I do. It's intense. I will give it that. It is an intense process. It's a lot of information. These children that are waiting for homes, they've been through a lot in their life, and you simply can't just adopt them thinking that everything's going to be perfect. You have to know their background, and you have to understand that they have to overcome a lot that they've gone through in life. And so, you know, there were definitely some of the training classes where you left with feeling disheartened and realizing all that these children have gone through. But for my husband, Josh, and myself, it just lit a fire under us that we can definitely help these children. They need parents who are supportive and willing to walk them through everything they've been through to heal from that and move on.
Okay. And so, again, it was, what did you say, 10 weeks?
10 weeks, yes.
10 weeks in that. And then what happened?
So from that point, you get a home study done. They come, Children Waiting Parents will come to your home and basically go through your home, make sure that everything is safe, make sure that everything's up to code, that it's an acceptable home, that there are beds for children, that it's clean. And from there, you have an approved home study. This approved home study is what gets sent to the caseworker of potential adoptive children. So from there, you can start sending your home study and hopefully find your child.
And did you feel any frustration with the process? Was it always, for lack of a better term, was it pretty smooth for you?
For us, it was, thanks to Veronica Black, it was smooth. We did have some hiccups with some other caseworkers in other agencies, but Children Waiting Parents has always been amazing to us. Really, really, truly amazing people, really good agency, organization, have helped us through any rough patches, have helped us advocate for our children, have helped us advocate for our family. And I just can't say enough good things about them.
And so now you've got a pretty bustling household.
Yes.
So can we talk, how are your kids doing?
They are wonderful. We started almost 9 years ago with just Alex entering our family.
And Alex was five?
He was five.
Okay.
Yeah, he was four. He was five when we adopted him. Yep.
Adopted him from the foster care system.
Mm-hmm.
So now that there's many kids, we'll get to that in a second.
Yes.
But when you start with Alex.
Yes.
For families who are thinking about this, about this process, what do you remember, you know, maybe, because this is not a newborn you're bringing home. You're bringing home a kid turning 5 years old from the foster care system. And you've gone through the training. You've thought about this. Of course, it's what you want. But what was maybe the biggest anxiety or fear that you had at that point?
I think the biggest shocker for us was that he didn't trust us. Because here in our minds, we're these trustworthy, supportive parents. But to him, we were strangers, and he didn't know if he could trust us or not. We needed to prove that trust, and the only way to do that is time, and over time, repeatedly proving your trust. It's not something that's earned immediately.
Wow, that's a big, powerful point, because you're probably thinking, we've been going through this process. Alex, you got no idea how hard we've been working on this. You're everything we want.
Yeah.
And you want him to know all of that coming in the door. But of course he doesn't. And of course, you know, some kids who go through the foster care system may have many reasons not to trust.
Right.
So how did that relationship develop?
For us, we did a lot of regression therapy type stuff. You know, he was a big 5-year-old, but all he wanted was to be treated like a baby. And so there's just some of that cuddling and snuggling and rocking that you have to do, because that earns trust with children. And always making sure you follow through on your word. If you say, we're going to the pumpkin patch today, and it doesn't happen, you just totally erased any trust that he had built up in you. You always have to follow through on your word.
Wow. Is this something that's earned and sort of evolved gradually? Did you have a moment where, you know, you say to the rest of your family who are getting to know Alex, it changed today, or a light kind of flipped?
I think it's gradual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's definitely a long, tiring process, but it is also an extremely rewarding process.
What's the relationship with Alex like now?
Alex is my right-hand man. He's 12 years old now. I could not do this crazy life without him. He is just amazing. He's the best big brother to the younger 7 siblings.
Oh, I'm sorry, 7. So
7.
I don't know if I had the right number there. All right, so we just started with Alex, so now we're walking through this. 2 years later, you adopted, at the time, a 6-year-old, right?
Yes.
James.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Also from the foster care system.
Yes.
So when you're making these decisions, you have to decide. I mean, at some point you have to decide, we want more of this. This is, you know, it may be hard at times. It's worth it. Yeah?
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
And did you ever doubt that?
No.
Never doubted that?
No.
Okay. And so tell me about James.
James is now 11. He came to us when he was 6. He was in the foster care system, and he had been for 4 years needing an adoptive home. And because of his past, many people were scared off by him. He was just one of those kids in the system who unfortunately has a long paperwork trail that doesn't accurately describe him. So he actually came to us from a day treatment program. And from there, we just advocated as hard as we could to get him the services that he needed to be successful in a family setting.
When you say the paperwork didn't accurately describe him, why do you think that was? What do you mean by that?
I believe that the environment he was living in at the time, it was not a healthy environment for him, and he acted out exponentially in his day treatment program. And you look at the paperwork on him, and here he is throwing chairs at teachers and screaming at everybody, and deep down in there was just this kid who wanted to be loved.
You had the advantage 2 years after adopting Alex of having probably the expectation that it's going to take some time.
Yes.
And, you know, again, building up that trust, et cetera. Did you see similarities with James that you saw with Alex? Maybe a lack of trust at first, a similar development that happened?
Yes. It was pretty much the same thing all over again. Needed to earn that trust, needed to earn the title mom and dad, and just be consistent.
Are they willing to call you mom and dad pretty quickly?
They are, yes. Okay. I find that they are clinging to someone to call mom and dad.
Interesting. But still in your mind, you kind of felt like you had to earn the title, that they may call you that, but they have to respect you that and really feel it in
yes.
their sort of in their bones that is mom and dad.
Yes.
Okay. That I can trust that this is mom and dad now, that this is a real relationship that's going to last. et cetera. Does it get easier when you do it multiple times, understanding the process?
Yes, I believe so.
You do?
It does, yes. People say, how can you do it all over again? And it's like, well, once you've done it once, you can just do it again.
How did Alex take that? You say Alex is a good big brother. How did it go at first?
Alex, at first, kind of saw competition, you know, the sibling rivalry, the jealousy. But we just kept instilling in him, you know, now you have other people to play with. You don't have to only play with mom and dad.
All right. And so the family has grown then.
Yes.
So now we've covered Alex and James.
Yes.
Who else should we talk about?
In 3 weeks, we are adopting our foster twins. We've had them for 3 years. So they are now 4 years old, and they will officially be Dohertys on National Adoption Day.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Wow. So, and that was 3 years ago that they came into your family?
Yes.
So they were around 1 year old?
Right.
Twins?
Yes.
You don't do anything easy.
No.
In the Dougherty household.
No.
As a twin myself,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
I know.
But you know what? It's I hope it's great, too. So that's different, though. One-year-old twins are very different than Alex was five, James mm-hmm. was six.
Yes.
So what kind of adjustment was that for your family?
Well, the fact that they were twins, that was definitely a crazy adjustment. They happened to be the exact same age as one of my biological sons. So we have three boys, all 4 years old. And the twins, as crazy and chaotic as it's been over the last 3 years, it's also just, oh, they're so funny. And they add so much joy to our family. I can't imagine it without them. In terms of, you know, definitely getting them at a younger age, yes, it is easier. But there's also that trauma that happens that first year of life that can never be erased, unfortunately, for many of these children. So from there, they do have to learn. There's always food available for me. There's always a mom here. I'm never home alone. The basics that so many children grow up just taking for granted. Even our twins had to learn that our house is a safe house with safe parents.
Wow. And you mentioned three other kids. So all throughout this process, you know, as you mentioned, you and your husband started the process that you did.
Yes.
For your own personal reasons, but then you end up having three biological children?
Four biological children.
Four biological children.
Yep. Yeah. Don't know.
So it's a big
Surprise.
Family. It's a
yes.
big family. And is that, you know, as much as they can, everyone gets along pretty well?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yep.
What an amazing thing. I want to ask you, if I could, Alicia, just to tell me a little bit and really tell listeners who have heard us discuss trauma mm-hmm. and the impact of trauma. And you really started to get into it with the idea that, you know, when you've had to bring children into your household who might not even safely assume that there's going to be food here, that there will be a parent here, that I'll be safe here. How do you see trauma impact Alex, James, the twins in sort of day-to-day ways? And do you see that change over time? In other words, does the impact of trauma lessen when they are surrounded by love?
It does lessen. What happens now is that there can be triggers for their PTSD, and you don't know when the triggers will happen. It could be something as simple as a police car drove past with its siren and lights on, and they're triggered back to that moment when they were removed from their birth family. And then from there, you have to rework again, telling them that they're safe and loved and they're not going anywhere.
Do you see something happen and do you generally know that, oh boy, this could be a trigger, or does it surprise you sometimes? Is it difficult that way?
It can surprise you sometimes. Yes, definitely. I've had school call and say, you know, James is having a tough day. Hmm. Something triggered him, and we have to kind of rewind our minds. Okay, what has happened that triggered him? And we make trips to school often. To kind of reassure him that you're not going anywhere, you're staying here in our family. Alex now, who's been with us 8 years, has finally accepted and understands that he's not going anywhere. So this is just something we know we have to earn with the other three.
And Alicia, I think just hearing the stories of what your family has done for the kids in your house, it's so admirable. It's really amazing. It's really important. And I understand why people would be hesitant to do it. What would your message be to people who've thought about it and they're hearing your story? And frankly, you know what? It sounds loving and beautiful, and it sounds hard.
Right.
It sounds hard too. And it is hard. So what's the message?
I think exactly what you said. It is hard, but it is rewarding and it is worth it. And, you know, I know people look at our family and they think it's perfect and everything's fun and games. But behind the scenes, it's a lot of work, and it's a lot of hard work, just being consistent and trustworthy and never giving up.
Would you do any of it differently now?
No. No, I'm ready to keep going, right, Veronica?
Yes, ma'am.
So there were numerous times, as Alicia was describing the story of the growing Dougherty family, that she looked over at Veronica Black and they shared a smile, or Veronica started to kind of have a big, broad smile, because obviously you have this relationship, but also Veronica has her own experiences. So what I want to do is take our only break of the hour and come back, and we're going to talk to Veronica Black-Turner, who is going to tell us about your family and what you've experienced. And we'll make sure, again, that you understand not only is November National Adoption Month, but we're here because there's a lot of questions about how best to help kids in need in our community. There are hundreds of kids, if not thousands, right here in Western New York who are looking for what they would call forever homes. And we're talking about that process. The organization is here to help you understand what they're all about and what they're doing. It's called Children Awaiting Parents. So let's get that only break of the hour, and we'll come right back with them next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, Parcel 5 gets a reboot. Is this an opening for park space, green space, or something else? Mayor Warren points us to Kansas City and their Power and Light District. We'll learn about that and more when we talk Parcel 5 first hour. Second hour, a panel takes a look at revitalizing Rust Belt cities. How can we do it? Is a performing arts center on the river part of that? We'll talk to you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Here is an email from Dave, who just says, listening now, all I have to say is, what an ethical family. What a beautiful story. So, Alicia, that's from a listener named Dave. And yet, Dave, you may want to... It's not all beauty all the time. Sometimes it's pure comedy. So Veronica's telling me during the break there that everyone should be following Alicia's. What were you telling? Tell our listeners what you told me during the break.
Well, Alicia has a blog that she writes, and she also has a large following on Facebook. She is hilarious, okay? And I think what makes her successful at this is that she's not uptight. They're not uptight. They're very lighthearted. They're flexible. They're, you know, easygoing. So they don't take things personally. They're not where some families may get upset or feel like the world is coming to an end, you know, based on a specific behavior, where Alicia finds humor in everything, you know. So I love the picture she shared for preschool of her son, first day of school, and you see him on the outside the front door on the mat laying face down. And she was trying to get a picture of him for you know, school. Everyone's sharing
back to school
their,
picture, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, their first day of school pictures. And it was just hilarious. She has some stories that, you know, you can't help but laugh at it. And I think, you know, that's what makes her so great, is the fact that she's not alarmed. She's willing to see things for what it is, but she's also, she's not uptight. She's like, okay, we'll get through this, you know, we'll work around this. But she also finds the humor and stuff. And, you know, I love that about her. She is amazing.
All right, so Alicia, you better tell us where we can find you online then.
On Facebook, you can find me at Alicia Medding Dougherty, or The Lit Brady Bunch.
The
Lit Brady
the
Bunch.
The Lit Brady Bunch.
Yes, that was name given to us by a foster teen that we had at one point.
You guys are like the lit Brady Bunch.
The lit Brady Bunch.
Oh, that's good. That's good. The lit Brady Bunch. So so thank you for that, Dave. And now we've opened the door for you all to be following Alicia's family story, where apparently the one of the themes is there's always room for one more. Who knows how big the yes. family will be the next time we talk to them. I want to turn back just a different email and a much more serious point from a listener named CT. And Veronica, I want to read this email and ask if you agree with how CT views the system. So here's what he writes. It says, no conversation about foster care and adoption should happen without the realization of what early childhood trauma is and that it can often result in PTSD and reactive attachment disorder. The foster system, he writes, does not want a potential adoptive family to know the true background of foster children, and the results are often tragic, with many families torn apart. Do you agree with him?
Well, yes and no. Now, I would have to say no when it comes to the foster care system, you know, not wanting the families to have that information or know how serious the needs are of the children, because that is not true. You know, we don't want failed adoptions. You know, we don't. And through that training, we focus on attachment. We focus on trauma. We focus on abuse, sex abuse, all those type of things. We do that. And for adoption, what we do is once the families have been matched with a child, we go through that child's file with a fine-tooth comb. Okay, we question everything, we read everything, we go through it with the families and help them make an informed decision whether or not this is for them, you know. And so yes, the beginning part of the email where the
trauma, PTSD,
yes,
that's all
yes,
real.
Yes, that is real. That is real. And I know my own children suffer from PTSD and other things. But we do want our families to be aware, okay? That is a fact. We want them to be aware. We want them to be educated. We want them to have the skills needed to be able to parent children with special needs. So, yeah, that's the part that kind of
I think
with.
Something different that Children Awaiting Parents does different from other agencies is that they have a mentor program. So whereas myself and my husband, we're currently parenting three children with reactive attachment disorder and PTSD. And it is not easy, but what Children Awaiting Parents does for their families is that they match us with new families so that we can walk them through this process of how to parent these children effectively.
What is a reactive attachment disorder? How would you describe that?
So this is where their needs were not met as a baby, just basic needs, food, cleanliness, shelter, love. And so from then on, they have learned not to trust that they will get those things in life. And this, like I said, is something that they need to learn over time in their new family, that they will have food, love, shelter, clean clothes, warmth.
And as we've described here, but just to kind of go back to CT's point there, you didn't feel like you didn't get the full story on your kids when you were going through that. It sounds to me like you were very aware of the challenge and the possible issues that may come up through the training, through the conversations, yeah?
Yes. And this does go back to what agency you're working with, because not everybody is as informed in the disorders that a child might have and what those might look like.
Okay, so CT, thanks for that, though. I mean, I certainly respect that viewpoint and that concern. And it sounds to me like the organization that's at least with us today, Children Awaiting Parents, doesn't want, as Veronica said, doesn't want people to end up with a failed adoption. I mean, nobody wants that in the system.
Right.
And can't speak for everybody involved with the entire process everywhere. But this is an organization, I think, that clearly cares about that. And Veronica, your own story, I think, sort of reflects that. So let's take it away from the organization. Let's talk about your personal story. And why don't you take me back to the process that you undertook?
Well, I've been with Children Awaiting Parents for 20 years, okay? And before I was employed there, I knew nothing about foster care or adoption. I knew nothing about it. And only what I heard, you know, the myth, the stereotypes and the you know, that negative stigma that's on there. But I didn't know the meat of it. I didn't know the facts. And working there, I learned about the children who were in care and their needs and how they enter into care because, you know, with that negative stigma, so many families believe the children are in care because of something that they've done, not realizing the children are not in care because of, oh, they're just bad kids. They're in foster care because we failed them, you know, the system, or as adults, as parents, you know, they're not there because of something they've done. So that was something that I had to learn first. And once I learned that, I decided, you know, that I was going to open up my home. You know, I was a single mom. I talked to my son about it, and I had to prepare him. Okay.
How old was he?
He was 4 when I decided that I was going to adopt.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at that time, you know, he was so young, but you, and this is with any child, regardless of their age, for parents who have biological children and are considering, you must prepare your children. You know, so what I did was I focused on teaching him about children in foster care who don't have mommies and daddies. They don't have toys. They don't get to go and play this sport, that sport. They don't have the same opportunities that you have, you know. And he developed that compassion, you know. So once he developed that compassion, I started to search. And I started to search, and I decided that I would do kids under the age of 10 and under. And I spoke with a caseworker, and he told me about maybe 6 kids he had on his caseload. And that's where I decided that Lennon was the one for me. And at that time, Lennon was 6 years old.
Lennon was 6, and yes. Your son was 4.
Yes.
And just kind of backing up to a point you just raised about preparing your son, mm-hmm. who was 4, there's a lot of research that indicates children start to develop empathy around the age of 6, mm-hmm. which I don't at all question the scientific research. What I do think is interesting is that kids have a pretty good sense of justice right out of the gate.
Yes.
In that, you know, kids especially, you don't find too many 2-year-olds who are like, you know, I'm talking about myself too much. How was your day? You know, that doesn't happen all that often. But, and kids especially 2, 3, 4 years old, they'll want all the dessert for themselves or all the toys for themselves. But if you explain it to them,
yes.
that you can have those things, but there's kids who have nothing,
yep.
they have a sense of, whoa, that's not fair.
Yes.
And I think kids are really good arbiters of
yes.
what justice is, even before the age of empathy. And it sounds
oh,
like
yes.
you experienced that too.
Yes, yes. We decided that we would do a little mini fundraiser, and it was called Change for Kids. And he understood exactly what it was. So everywhere we would go, if he saw a penny on the ground, he would pick it up. And he's like, oh, mommy, change. Here's more change, you know. And if he's at the playground playing with the kids, he would say stuff like, I'm going to find you a daddy. I'm going to find you. And I have to apologize to all the parents around. And I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry, you know. And he's like, but mommy, he don't have. I said, yes, he has a father, you know. But, you know, he has so much compassion. And he was so excited about having a brother, someone to play with and, you know, someone to grow with. And I wanted that for him. And they do tell you that you should not disrupt the birth order. You know, that is something that, you know, we share with our families. And my thing with that is I tell families, you have to know your child,
mm-hmm.
your biological child. You have to know. And I knew that I could not walk in my home with someone who was younger, you know, because he was my baby. So, and plus, I didn't want to go that young anyway. So, but, yeah, so after, you know, receiving Lennon's file and, you know, going through it and learning about his needs and his background, I decided that, you know, he was the one for me. You know, he was the perfect kid for us, and I felt like we would be the perfect family for him. And, you know, we started our visitations and overnights, and I watch how the boys interact and... you know, being connected with children awaiting parents, I was able to identify resources like therapists and doctors and stuff like that. And so I kind of had like the advantage, you know. So my son's placement, it wasn't as, it was kind of smooth. You know, it wasn't difficult at all.
Oh,
but
that's good.
Yeah. But he does have needs. I've had plenty of nights where, you know, I wake up and I'm thinking, you know, I need more support. And you know, it's there. It's out there.
The dynamic that Alicia talked about, just understanding that a child coming from the foster system being adopted isn't going to walk in the door the first day and say, I trust you implicitly. You know, I get it. So I take that point. What is the dynamic like when you have a four-year-old, a biological child who's four, you're adopting a child who's six, who may have, and almost certainly does have, trauma or experiences that are really rough and tough and difficult that your biological son does not have and may not understand and may encounter those kinds of emotional issues?
Well, we did experience a lot of that when he did have his meltdowns and breakdowns or whatever you want to call it. My son, my other son, he did not understand. And I could see, you know, the wheels turning. He was kind of confused. But it only you know, informed me more that we need to not just him receive the therapy. We all need to go in and do the family therapy so that, you know, my other son, he's informed. You know, I know he was young, but I didn't want him to be alarmed and think that, oh my goodness, this is bad, or he's a bad kid, because he's not. You know, there's no such thing as a bad kid, just, you know, bad choices.
Well, and then that didn't deter you from then looking at bringing a couple more boys into your home.
Yes, once Lennon and Styles were adjusted and settled, I discussed it with them. You know, adopting again.
And what do they think?
Oh, they were so psyched and so happy. And I was thinking one child, you know. And after I was matched with Ian, his caseworker called and told me that he had a brother who was in care. They were living in separate foster homes, and they wanted to know if I would take both of them. And she said, you don't have to answer now, you know, just think about it. And, of course, I'm going to say yes, but I talked to my boys about it, and they were so psyched and excited, and they're like, Mom, we'll help you, we'll help you. We promise we're going to help you out, you know, my older two, Styles and Lennon. And that was not true. They just wanted some more kids to play with.
I thought we were going to this beautiful, you know, they were...
No, being honest, no. Mm-mm. They just wanted someone else to play with, and that's all it was. You know?
But they were excited.
Oh, yes, they were so happy. That's great. They were so happy, and it was a blessing.
All right, so you brought in two boys who were how old?
Well, they were at that time, I want to say five. Well, they were six and four.
Six and four.
Yes. And when I finalized, Ian was seven and Joubert was five.
Okay, so. 7 and 5, and your kids were, I think, what, 10 and 12, 11 and 13, something like that?
They're like stair steps now.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and how is life now?
Oh, my goodness. I tell everyone my house is live. It's always live. You know, there's no such thing as a quiet, quiet day at my house. It's always live. They're all happy. Everyone's healthy and active and doing well in school. And, we still have our challenges, but it's nothing that we can't handle because we have a lot of support around us. And, you know, that's something that families who are considering adopting need to know. You know, you can do it alone, but you really need support. You have to identify your support system beforehand.
All right, I want to get a phone call and an email, and then what we'll do before the hour's out is we'll make sure that Lori and Veronica have you aware of not only the opportunities in our community, how to get in touch with them, and other events coming up. So, but let me grab a first phone call, and this is Karen in Brockport. Go ahead, Karen.
Good afternoon. I wanted to give a perspective. Oftentimes, foster parents, adoptive parents are, you're so wonderful, you're so great. And as a former foster parent, I wanted to put out the fact how much my family, my children, myself, was enriched by that experience. My kids, who are now young adults, they were able to get to know parts of the community that they would have never, ever had. And that was the same with me. So it's a two-way street. It's a gift both ways. Mm.
Karen, thank you for that. Thoughts from the panel? I think just a lot of nodding around the table.
Definitely, yes. Thank you, Karen. You're absolutely right.
So that's Karen. Let me read Dan's email with some questions for our guests then. Dan's wondering, are people who are economically poor allowed to adopt a child, or are there income requirements? Are there differences between agencies or adoption routes with regards to the economic status of prospective parents? Are some agencies more flexible than others? And what about credit score? Can people with low credit scores, for example, from outstanding student loan debt, adopt a child?
Okay, well, there's no income requirement, but what we do is we do ask to see that you're able to, you know, take care of yourself, you're self-sufficient. We need to see, you know, we do ask for all your financial information, and if you have low income, That's a tough one. You have to be able to meet your own needs in order to take care of a child. So, you know, it's
and there's so much.
Go ahead, Lauren. Get right on that mic.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of support and assistance out there, but the reality is we have to look at just what you said, Veronica, that the family can sustain themselves and the child that may be coming into their home. So while I think we're willing to work with everyone, we would need to make sure that the child's needs could be met.
Okay. Yes, that is very true.
Yeah, I mean, okay. Dan, I hope that answers the question. So it doesn't sound like there's a hard yes or no. I think it sounds like everyone's going to be evaluated and they don't want to discriminate based on income.
Right,
but they
exactly.
have to be very careful and make
right,
sure the kids' needs can be met. So we've just got a few minutes left here. Let me ask Lori and Veronica to let our listeners know. First of all, if you want to get in touch with the agency, Children Awaiting Parents, how to do that, and then what you got coming up that you want the community to know about. So go ahead.
Well, we have several events for the for November, which is the National Month of Adoption. And the first event that is occurring is actually this Saturday, October 27th. And that is the immersion experience event that we talked about with the train ride. That is begins at 11 a.m. And we have Ginny Ryan doing she's going to be our MC for
that
her. Event.
Yes.
And so we're pretty excited about that.
And by the way, listeners, that's out at, I always call it just called the Train Museum. I think it's the Transportation Museum, but it's a really cool place. My son's always liked it out there. And they're going to do... sort of a reenactment and a 14-minute train ride, which would be very interesting to help learn about what orphan trains were. So,
absolutely. We are encouraging children over the age of 12 and being cautious about those children who've experienced trauma, you know, being part of this experience. Then next event after the train immersion is the Judge Wagner Heart Gallery reception at the Strong Museum. That is Friday, November 2nd, and it begins at 5:30. That is also a free event. And Veronica will be conducting a panel there. I don't know if you want to say more about that.
Yes, yes. We will have a panel of available children and families who have adopted, and both will share their experiences. And also Alicia will be joining us on that panel. So that's going to be quite exciting.
Yes. All eight Very kids good. Will be there if you want to see them.
Yes. Oh.
The lit Brady Bunch
yes.
is going to be there in
yes.
person.
Yes. yes.
Okay.
So we're encouraging families to come out to that. And then... we have some other events on November 14th at Writers and Books. There's a book talk, and I think you can both purchase the book through the Writers and Books or through our agency, and you can attend that book talk on the 14th, which is at 7 p.m. And then our big event takes place on Tuesday, November 27th from 12 to 1:30. And that is at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. It is the 2018 Heart Gallery Luncheon event. And at that event, the author of The Orphan Train will be our keynote speaker. And our founders, Peggy and Dave Sewell, will be awarded the 2018 Heart Gallery Award. So that promises to be a wonderful event. We're looking forward to it and very hopeful that our listeners will want to attend.
All right, that's Tuesday, November 27th, starting at noon at the Riverside Convention Center. Tickets are still available.
Yes.
If you want to get in touch with the organization, that's Children Awaiting Parents, and the website childrenawaitingparents.org.
Yes. .org.
Okay. And so, big month ahead. And I want to thank all of our guests for being here and sharing your stories, educating our community on this. I really appreciate that. And Alicia, good luck to you, Alicia Dougherty. And online, find her on Facebook, follow her blog, The Lit Brady Bunch, and it's really great stuff. Continued great success in your family. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Our thanks to Veronica Black, who is not only adoption program supervisor, but an adoptive parent who shared her remarkable story. Continued success and health to your family. Thanks for being here this hour.
Thank you.
And Lori McKnight, the executive director of Children Awaiting Parents and the Donald J. Corbett Adoption Agency. Lori, thanks. Appreciate your time this hour.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Our thanks to John Andrus, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we will be back with you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.